Hello and welcome to season two of 180 Degrees. For the next eight episodes, we're sharing stories from people across Ireland who are working towards a cleaner energy future. We chat to the people who are making a real difference in the area of sustainable transport. We talk about energy in the home and in our communities. We hear from businesses who are cutting carbon emissions, and we learn how energy research is shaping Ireland's future. 180 Degrees is brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland and is supported by the Government of Ireland. Today's episode is called How Energy Research is Shaping Ireland's Future. Hello, I'm your host, Louise Ryan, and joining me today is Dr. Lucy Corcoran from the Research and Innovation Department at SEAI and Paul Blunt, Portfolio Director at Quailsha. In this episode, we will be chatting about how energy research is informing Ireland's climate action plan. Paul has a wealth of experience in the field of wind energy and is the Irish Wind Energy Association's Person of the Year for 2020. He led the model development and analytics aspects of an innovative research project supported by SEAI. The project focused on investigating and modelling a range of curtailment mitigation options for high levels of renewable electricity on the Irish electricity system in 2030 and 2040. And for anyone who has no idea about what curtailment mitigation is, don't switch off just yet. We will reveal all very soon. Dr. Lucy Corcoran leads a range of energy research and innovation activities at SEAI. Welcome, Lucy and Paul. Thanks for joining me here today. And welcome to all our listeners.
Thanks, Louise. Good to be here.
Lucy, let's kick things off with you. Tell me why energy research in Ireland is so important and how SEAI is supporting this sector.
Well, energy research has a really crucial role to play in transforming and decarbonising Ireland's energy. So in particular, to support our longer term energy and climate targets. We know we need to decarbonise our energy sector and we need to use less energy and become more energy efficient and move towards cleaner energy sources for electricity, heat and transport. But we don't have all the answers yet. So that's why we really need energy research and for the energy research community to investigate and to discover and develop new solutions to help accelerate our clean energy transition. At SEAI, we support energy research in a number of different ways. We provide energy research funding through the National Energy Research Development and Demonstration Funding Programme. This runs as an annual competitive call to support innovative projects like Paul's project, which we'll hear about later. We also lead and coordinate Irish participation in international energy research collaborations, so through the IEA, the International Energy Agency, and also through European funding initiatives like Horizon 2020 and the upcoming Horizon Europe funding, where we act as the national delegate for energy. Another key focus area of the research and innovation activities in SEAI is on improving the impact of energy research projects in Ireland and to support researchers in communicating their research to make sure that research outputs move from a report or from the desk into both policy and practice. So we've developed an online database, which is a central hub of all publicly funded energy research projects. We also host an annual national conference series where we bring the Irish energy research and the policy communities together to get a discussion going on how we can approach our energy challenges.
Perfect. Lucy, can you just bring it to life for us and give us some examples of the types of research projects that SEAI has funded in the past?
Yes, so we've completely revitalised our supports for energy research in the past 3 years. And we've supported, since 2018, over 100 different projects. And these are across a whole range of different sectors, different renewable energy technologies, across building energy, across different disciplines as well. So not just engineering and technical solutions, but also research in other disciplines like social sciences, behavioral economics, and finance. And some examples, so we support projects like investigations into the potential for floating offshore wind in Ireland, and projects looking at applying advanced analytics techniques and big data for improving forecasting models for renewable energy, as well as community-focused projects, which is really important to make sure that people and communities are at the centre of all these solutions.
Can you give us an example of some of the types of community projects, Lucy?
Yeah, there's a few ongoing research projects looking at social engagement in community energy. So there's one project that's investigating different support tools for community renewable energy, and that involves the development of an online tool to help to empower community groups to self-organize and to plan and to finance their own renewable energy projects. And I suppose in terms of other projects over the past few years, we've also developed a number of strategic co-funding partnerships with other government departments and agencies, and also with key energy industry stakeholders. And this has, first of all, it's allowed us to leverage additional funding and support for Irish energy research, but it also allows us to expand and support projects in different cross-sectoral areas. So, for example, in the transport energy area, we're supporting a number of projects with the Department of Transport. And in terms of geothermal energy, we've partnered with Geological Survey Ireland to the GSI to co-fund projects relating to geothermal energy. And with the ESB, we're currently co-funding a project looking at novel options for cleaning wind turbine blades. So that would help to further enhance and improve the performance of existing wind turbines and then lead to increased energy generation potential. And you can find much more detail about these in our online National Energy Research Database. So if anyone's interested, I'd really encourage you to log on to the SEI website and to search for your interests here. So you could search for wind energy projects or community projects or ocean energy, and you'll see all details of the different projects that are being funded in Ireland at the moment.
I was only on it the other day, actually, and there's so many projects in there, so it's definitely worth having a scroll through. So, Paul, before we get into your energy research project, can you tell us a little bit about your role as portfolio director in Quilcha and your previous experience in the wind sector?
Sure, Louise. Yeah. So I suppose I would have started working in the wind sector, I think, around 2009. So I joined ABO Wind Ireland as a construction manager to begin with. And I was a few years later promoted to the role of director with ABO Wind. So this was 10, 11 years now working in the wind industry. So I joined the senior management team in Quilcha as portfolio director in January 2019. We're a team of just under 30 people. We've a good number of project managers, and then various kind of specialist support roles across grid, planning, finance, land security, and community engagement. And I suppose as a team, our medium-term ambition is to deliver 1 gigawatt of new onshore wind projects in Ireland by 2030. So personally, I'd have an oversight responsibility across a range of those projects. And I'd also do quite a bit of work in the policy and regulatory space as well to kind of both, keep ourselves abreast of developments in the policy and regulatory space and, where appropriate, try to help shape that and try and move the policy and regulatory in a direction that supports the development of renewables in a kind of a cost-effective way. So that's where I spend a lot of my time.
Okay, so the first thing I need to ask is this project focuses on wind curtailment. For anyone listening, including myself, who isn't familiar with this term, can you just kind of give us a brief explanation of what curtailment actually is?
Yeah, I mean, I to avoid going into the bamboozling technical detail, at the simplest possible level, it's what happens when there's more wind power than the power system is able to accommodate at any given moment in time. So I'd say today it most often occurs on windy nights. So at nighttime, the demand for electricity is relatively low. And if the wind is blowing strong at nighttime, you tend to have more power coming from wind than the system is capable of accommodating. And when that happens, the power system operator needs to send a signal to the various wind farms to tell them to turn down their output in order to keep the system in balance. So that action of the system operator telling the wind farm generators to turn their power down is what's described as curtailment of wind power.
Okay, that actually makes sense. And is that, I assume, so we have a lot of windy nights. Is it otherwise wasted if that doesn't happen?
That's what we were trying to do with this research is to find ways to prevent that from happening. And there's a wide number of strategies that you can try to employ to prevent that from happening. But yeah, effectively, unless you've got long duration storage technologies, when that gets turned down, typically it's wasted. It's not, you can't put it aside and use it later. The power system operates minute by minute. That you have to keep the power system in balance at all times. When you turn down wind at the moment, that power goes to waste. So that's renewable power that is not able to be utilized.
Okay. So tell us about the energy research project that you were involved in. If you want to tell us how it came about, what your aims were, all those kind of things.
Sure, yeah, it's a little bit of a long story. It would have started as a hobby project. So I had been working on a hydrogen pilot project, and I came to learn that one of the unique selling points, if you like, of hydrogen is the ability of hydrogen to store large amounts of renewable electricity. So I just asked myself the question, how much storage would you need to get to a 100% resi system? So I built a simple model and kind of worked nights and weekends on that, and started running some basic analysis and generating some reasonably interesting results kind of fairly quickly. And I then decided, well, I'd engage with somebody who had done more work in this space already. So I reached out to Mullen Group Consulting, who will be one of the leading grid consultancies in Ireland, who we worked with. And between myself and Rory Mullen in Mullen Grid, we kind of went backwards and forwards and refined the model over a period of time to add functionality and to be able to answer more complex questions. So it was at that point then that we got in touch with some colleagues in the Irish Wind Energy Association, IWEA, and they were working on what would be a credible renewable electricity target for Ireland for 2030. And this was the work that myself and Rory were doing were leading us to believe that we could plausibly target a 70% renewable electricity level in Ireland. Not long after that, David Connolly joined the team. And he has a huge amount of modeling experience as well, and he was seeing similar kinds of results. And so IWEA then went on to procure a separate piece of work that showed in a pretty robust way that was a credible target. But the bit that we felt was missing at the end of that work was that was a very detailed costed scenario of this high renewable penetration system, but it didn't necessarily explain what the most important elements of that complex jigsaw puzzle were. So myself and Rory kind of felt that it would be worth us taking the work that we had done somewhat informally earlier and kind of putting it on a more robust, academically strong footing, if you like. And so we applied to SEI for some funding to effectively develop that work further and write up the results and kind of spend the time disseminating it properly to some of the key stakeholders. So that was maybe the background to that.
And Paul, for your project, you investigated and modelled a number of different options to mitigate curtailment. Can you tell us about the different options or the different scenarios that you considered?
Yeah, so what we did from a modelling perspective was we took the system as it exists today in 2020, and we said, well, from a modelling perspective, let's try and get to this high renewable penetration level simply by adding more wind capacity. And so we modelled more and more and more wind until we reached 70%, and we found that it was actually theoretically possible, even if you did nothing, you can get to that kind of a level. And so we did that, but we found that about something over 40% of all of the available power was going to waste through curtailment. So then we went about looking at a whole range of different measures. It gets a little bit kind of technically complicated here, I would say, but the first one we looked at was relieving operational constraints on the system. So this is effectively technical restrictions that EirGrid have to impose on the system in order to maintain the voltage and frequency stability. And what we were finding is, as of today, we're only able to put about 65% of the power can come from wind today. And after that, EirGrid have to dispatch downwind or turn wind down if it goes over that level. So what we found in our analysis was that was probably the single most important thing that you have to do in order to allow more wind on the system, to create the space on the system for more wind. We also looked at things like adding interconnector capacity, so exploring the addition of the Greenlink interconnector and the Celtic interconnector to France. We looked at things like blending some solar with wind. So what you see with solar and wind is there can be a negative correlation in terms of when the two technologies are generating power. And so they're relatively complementary. And we found that was a beneficial thing to do in terms of curtailment. We also looked at higher capacity factor wind. So that's effectively selecting turbine models that have a higher percentage on average of their rated power coming from wind energy. So we explored all those different elements, and we kind of were able to identify. We also looked at things like demand side management, battery storage, and other technologies, and we were able to impose all of those individual measures, first of all, individually to compare which ones were having the biggest benefit. And then we started, you know, adding them together to see just how high you could get in terms of a renewable electricity level on the system.
What were the outcomes of the project then, Paul, at the end of it?
Yeah, so I would say it was the first outcome I would say was that we certainly identified the need to get to this 90 to 95% instantaneous penetration limit was probably the most important measure. It creates the most space and it's the most safe space. So that's effectively, I would say as of today, Ireland is already absolutely at the cutting edge worldwide in terms of integrating renewable power on the system. And that 65% limit that Airgrid are currently working with, and hopefully soon to be 75%, that is a world leading level in terms of a single synchronous power system. But what our analysis is showing, fortunately or unfortunately for all the wizards in Airgrid, is, you know, we're going to need them to do even more.
Okay.
we need them to take what is already world leading work and build on it and go further. And, you know, what's great to see actually is that, and not necessarily saying it was solely on the back of this work, but I think Airgrid were probably coming to a similar conclusion independently. But that is now their strategy, and their plan is to take the power system to the point where it can get to those kinds of penetration levels by 2030. So that was probably the single most important measure. And I'd say the next most important measure was the addition of the new interconnector capacity to GB in France. So what our modeling showed was that this additional interconnector capacity has very, very significant potential to support the integration of renewables. The only difference with the interconnectors is it does come with a little degree of risk. So what you want with interconnectors is at times of high wind, you want the interconnectors being able to export that power to other jurisdictions, and at times of lower wind to be importing it. But the actual physical flows on the interconnectors are determined by the pricing in different jurisdictions. So I would say while it's... it has massive potential to integrate renewables, that there's more of a degree of risk when it comes to interconnectors, that, you know, if the power doesn't flow the way you think it will, you know, it's not quite as safe, I suppose, as the first measure. But as you layer, like, that's maybe the two top measures. But, you know, there's lots of progress can be made by taking those two and then adding on some of the other measures that had a positive impact, but it just wasn't maybe quite as strong. But I'd say they were probably the two most important conclusions from the research that we did.
And you mentioned there one of the challenges with the interconnectors. Kind of what other challenges did you encounter while trying to get this project over the line?
I'd say at a personal level, the biggest challenge was finding the time.
you did start it as a hobby.
Yeah. Obviously, this was done kind of alongside a fairly busy day job. But we had a great team, like between the guys at Mullen Grid, James Carton as well, did a huge amount helping us put shape on the report. Connor Ford, he's now working with Mullen Grid. You know, he did great work on pulling together the presentations that we needed to disseminate this research to the key stakeholders. So, it took a lot because we all had kind of this wouldn't we're not other than James, I suppose, none of us were professional researchers, if you like. We all had pretty busy day jobs as well. So that was probably actually just on the personal level. It was a push time wise, but we all rolled up the sleeves and we got it done. At a technical level, it was probably getting the input assumptions right, calibrating the model to make sure that it was generating results that were comparable with what you're seeing in the real world. Probably some of the key challenge areas. And just actually, you know, when you see a finished product, there was quite a bit of thought at the beginning just to framing the analysis and thinking about, you know, what are we trying to show here? And structuring the analysis in a way that it was able to generate these kind of very useful insights, that when you see the finished product, you sometimes wouldn't realize that it actually took quite a bit of thought just to shape the structure of the analysis. So that was probably a bit of a challenge at the beginning.
Oh, I can imagine. And I think that's so inspiring to hear that you're not a researcher by day. So to other people out there who might, you know, have an idea, you know, it shouldn't be kind of a barrier to them either, that it isn't their day job.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting, Paul, when you talked about how you came up with the idea and how you kind of framed the research question and how you brought the different team members together and engage with people. And I know you mentioned that communication and dissemination was really important for the project. Can you tell us a bit about what kind of communications activities that you found most effective, or what the different dissemination activities you were involved in were?
You have to have a well-written and robust report, I think, to back everything up. But, you know, what you realize when you're working in the energy business for a while is, you know, everyone, it's quite a thin industry. It's not, every stakeholder across industry, across, you know, government departments, across the regulators, across the system operators, you know, everyone is pretty stretched and pretty busy. There's no one with a lot of time on their hands. So, you know, just kind of sending on reports and hoping people will read them, I think won't get the job done. So for me, you know, the most important dissemination activity was really reaching out to the key stakeholders individually, going and meeting them, having a very, very clear slide deck pulled together that you can actually explain to them the results and explain the insights. And, you know, rather than somebody trying to sit down for a few hours and read a report, it's amazing how much you can do if you've got 20 minutes to just present the results and it's pulled together in a clear way. So, like, I'd say that was probably, you know, in terms of getting the message across to the people who it was important understood the message, you know, those individual meetings with those key stakeholders, I think were probably the most important part of that dissemination exercise, I would say. And I think, like maybe to come back to the point you're making earlier in terms of the team, like the other thing, again, when you're working in this industry for a while, it can seem quite simple, but it's actually an incredibly complex industry, and there's so many different specialities and, you know, different elements to it. And, you know, nobody would be capable of doing this kind of work, you know, on their own. So it's really important actually that you bring the right mix of people into any kind of research project, so that you've got, let's say, all the bases covered in terms of the relevant expertise. And so it was really a pleasure on this project to work with the likes of Rory and his team in Mullen Grid, and James Carton as well in DCU. Like, the, you know, having that kind of team of people working with you on a project like this is key.
Yeah, and you mentioned a couple of times, Paul, that the renewable electricity target, the 70% renewables by 2030, and this research really, I suppose, informed and supported that target that was included in the Climate Action Plan. Could you talk to us a bit about how that came about, or how the research, your particular research work, has supported government policy?
Yeah, I would say in the first instance, it was one of the inputs that would have helped form IWEA's view that was kind of the right target to aim for. So, you know, between myself and Rory and you know, David Connolly and IWEA and a few other kind of key people in the Irish Wind Energy Association, it would have been one of the inputs into that, and that was kind of a key step. So once the Wind Energy Association, let's say, bought into the idea that this was actually a stretch target, but a credible target to aim for, that actually, let's say, brought a lot more people and resources to bear on pushing for this target. And so I suppose this would have been maybe one of the elements of work that was there at the genesis of that. That ultimately culminated in the report that the Wind Energy Association commissioned. That it would have been the Bringa 70 by 30 report. And, you know, that was, I'd say, a key report in terms of getting the target put in place. But what the other bit where I think the work that myself and Rory and James did, where I think that's important, is it showed why things like the DS3 Plus program are so important. So it's not that our research is solving the really complex technical issues of operating a power system at these very, very high penetration levels. You know, that's for the wizards at Airgrid and you know, supported by ESB and NIE and others. But what I think it did is it helped explain to non-technical people, so the likes of the department or maybe the non-technical people in the Commission for Regulation Utilities, it helped explain to them why it is that that it's so important that Airgrid are supported in delivering this very high penetration level system. You know, Airgrid can have all the technical skills in the world, but if they don't have the mandate, or they don't have the funding, or, you know, or the market design evolution doesn't support what they're trying to do, then they won't be able to get there. And if they don't get there, then the target won't get there. So I'd say, yeah, we were probably there at the genesis of the target as one of the inputs. And once the target was established, we're kind of helping to show what the most important things that you need to do are if you're going to actually hit that number.
And speaking of those targets, the 70-30, I just want to open this up to the two of you. So how do you think research is supporting policy decisions and helping Ireland to meet those climate action targets?
In the first instance, like in this particular case, as I say, it was the importance of it is showing we were able to make it clear to government departments why it's so important that EirGrid are properly funded to be able to do the work that they need to get to this high renewable penetration. So that's maybe, you know, if they aren't supported in doing that, then the targets, you'll never get to 70% in any kind of a commercially feasible way. So that's maybe in our particular case that was one of the benefits of this work, and there's probably, hopefully there's others as well, but I'd say more generally, what's become clear is that, you know, climate change is certainly going to be the challenge of our generation, and the changes that we're going to need to see in electricity and in energy actually more generally in the next 10 to 20 years, it's going to be at a scale that's really nothing like we've seen since the Industrial Revolution. Like we're talking about absolutely fundamentally changing how we power our economies. And with that amount of change, you simply won't achieve it without good research. And I'm thinking of things like, there's a lot of very complex research needed to get the power system decarbonized. But actually in Ireland, we're pretty good at that, and we're well placed to take the next steps on that. Things like heat and transport are going to be maybe trickier. And, I think there's a huge role for further research in that area to kind of get to decarbonize energy more generally.
Yeah, it's really important for research to feed into policy, and for policy as well to feed back to the researchers. So one area that we focus on is our annual conference, where we bring the research and policy community together. And this is really to make sure that government policy is informed by the best and most scientific research possible, and also that researchers are aware of the policy perspective and what the big challenges are from a policy side, so that they know where to focus on in research. But as Paul said, really it's a fundamental change to our whole energy system across heat, transport and electricity, and we need as much research and innovation to help us to accelerate and come up with solutions to meet that transition. So research really is fundamental there to support policy. Paul, what are the next steps for your project, or for your maybe future research ambitions? Is there anything, do you have anything coming up in the pipeline?
I've nothing at the moment in terms of formal research funding. Like obviously, let's say at a commercial level, we're always looking to research kind of new opportunities and maybe taking some of the insights from some of this work and seeing, starting to think about where the technological opportunities for us as a business, when you look at where the system needs to change and what needs to happen, like, that presents opportunities for new technologies. So I'd say at a commercial level, we're certainly starting to think about that a little bit. But at the moment, I don't have any immediate plans to do more research in this space. But I'm continuing to work with the Wind Energy Association on new bodies of work, and we are starting to think about things like, what would a zero carbon system in 2050 look like? Starting to look at things like that right now with the Wind Energy Association. That's about.
You should have loads of time in lockdown, Paul, to start another hobby project.
I think I've used up all my hobby projects. My wife is, she's an extremely patient woman, thankfully, but it has its limits.
I just want to put a final question to you both. What do you think the future of energy research in Ireland looks like?
From my side, I would say like it's the collaboration between industry and academia, I think, is a key part of it. So the academic world, I think, brings an enormous body of knowledge, a lot of technical skills, modeling capabilities. And on the industry side, we have the experience of knowing what it takes to actually deliver the technologies onto the energy system, not just the power system. So from my side, I think something you would like to see is lots more of this kind of collaborative research between the academic consultancy / industry. I think that hopefully will be a big part of research in Ireland in the future in the energy system.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think there's a huge opportunity for the Irish research community for businesses and companies and public sector to come together and, as Paul said, collaborate on these solutions. And as well as that, there's obviously an opportunity for new enterprise development and employment. So there'll be lots of benefits for the Irish economy as well of this increase in collaboration and research and innovation. So I think 2020 has been obviously a difficult year for all of us, but one of the silver linings that I see is that we have an opportunity now to rebuild our economy and to make sure that it's more sustainable and that it's a green recovery. And there's been a huge focus at government level on this, as well as at the European level with the European Green Deal. So I think there will be great opportunities coming for funding and support for the energy research community and businesses in Ireland. And from SEAI's perspective, I'd encourage everyone to keep an eye out for our next research call, which is due to open in early 2021. And that will be, again, another opportunity to apply for funding to collaborate with different companies and researchers and academia, come up with a research proposal and apply into us for funding. So everyone get thinking of your ideas now and bring your team together.
So that's it from all of us here today at the 180 Degrees podcast. I want to thank both my guests, Paul Blunt and Lucy Corcoran, for joining me today. Thanks a million. I hope you've enjoyed it and we'll see you next time.
Great.
Thanks, Louise.
Thanks for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, then please like, share and subscribe to our podcast wherever you're listening now. You'll find previous episodes on our website, seai.ie/podcast, along with information about our grants and supports. See you next week.